This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary, 27th of February, 1989. We're in hearing room 343 at the State Capitol, having hearings on the following bills. Work session on Senate Bill 299, 275, 276, 516. Public hearing and work session on 632.
Why don't you go ahead for it? Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Corey Streisinger. I'm Governor Goldschmidt's legal counsel, and I'm here today to offer the governor's support for Senate Bill 275. This bill would expand the circumstances under which a child's out-of-court report of sexual abuse would be admissible in evidence. Under present law, when a child reports that he or she has been abused, the details of that report are ordinarily not admissible. Rule 803.18a of the Oregon Evidence Code allows evidence of the fact that a report was made, but the details of the report, no matter how persuasive and reliable, and no matter whether the child is available for cross-examination, cannot be included unless some other exception to the hearsay rule applies. Senate Bill 275 would allow reports of sex abuse by children under the age of 10 to be used in evidence in limited circumstances. First, the facts surrounding the report would have to include substantial indicia of reliability, as defined in the bill. In determining reliability, the judge could consider such issues as whether the statement contains details that the child would be unlikely to fabricate, whether the statement was spontaneous or made in response to leading questions, and whether the statement is internally consistent. If the child is competent and available as a witness, Senate Bill 275 would require the child to testify in court and be cross-examined. And if the child is not available as a witness, the evidence could be admitted only if it were independently corroborated. Senate Bill 275 represents a carefully crafted attempt to deal with a very troublesome area. It draws a balance between the traditional rules of hearsay and the realities of child sex abuse cases. On behalf of the governor, I urge your support. With me today is Betty Yucatil, Assistant Administrator for the Children's Services Division. I'd like to turn this over to her to describe some of the details of these cases, and then we'll both be available for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betty Yucatil. I'm an Assistant Administrator for Children's Services Division. In child sexual abuse cases, there are rarely witnesses. Direct evidence and circumstantial evidence other than hearsay may not be available. At present, it is the young victim's ability to verbalize in the courtroom the details of his or her abuse which will most likely determine the outcome. The child is often under pressure to recant or is simply so young that he or she cannot adequately verbalize the sexual victimization and therefore may not be a competent witness. This is of increasing concern as Oregon had 2,077 victims of sexual abuse under the age of six in 1986-1987. The average age at which male victims disclose molestation was 7.8 years of age. For female victims, the average age at which they disclosed molestation was 9.7 years. Once the disclosure occurs, these young victims are faced with the harsh realities of present evidentiary procedures. Under certain circumstances, a collaborative statement admitted as evidence would provide the court with needed information to make a more judicious decision regarding the child's need for protection and, in cases of criminal prosecution, conviction of offenders. There would be no criminal convictions based on hearsay alone. Senate Bill 275 offers evidentiary support to child victims of sexual abuse while clearly defining a procedural approach which will ensure fairness to the defendant. We strongly encourage your support for Senate Bill 275.
What questions,
Madam Chair, Corey, what say if a child is competent and available, the child would testify. How is competent defined? Is it defined in the bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, actually competence in hearsay lingo is a species of availability. A witness who is not competent in the sense of not knowing I can't recall the specific details for ordinarily competence of a witness, but not being able to be put under oath and understand the meaning of the oath is not considered to be an available witness. A witness who also has no present recollection is not considered to be an available witness. The bill does not contain independent definitions. It relies on the general rules for availability and unavailability in hearsay cases.
Okay, thank you.
Dale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask permission, Mr. Collins from our association, Yamhill County District Attorney, has worked on this bill for a number of sessions, and he just walked in and he has written comments, and I would defer to him if I may do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
275, are we? Oh.
Yes, Ms. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm John Collins, Yamhill County District Attorney and past president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. This bill, Senate Bill 275, is a bill that we have supported for the last three sessions, and the committee may know some history of it passing the House last session and did not get a hearing, I think, in the Senate this last time. So we are asking for that hearing now and urging the committee to pass the bill out with a due pass recommendation. I have prepared some written testimony, and I believe that's being passed out at this time, and I'll endeavor to summarize it. Under current law, the details of a report of a child victim of sexual abuse is not admissible unless it falls under one of the existing exceptions to the hearsay rule, such as excited utterance or the report to a treating physician. The actual statement made by the child is not admissible under the report of sexual misconduct exception, that's Rule 803, because that exception is limited to the fact of the complaint, not the content of the complaint. It's also not admissible under the general catch-all exception, as the court pointed out in State versus Campbell. Thus, the child's initial report and subsequent reports, what may be the child's most candid statements, are not admitted in court, and the jury is left to speculate regarding what are very logical questions. That is, what did the child say when the matter was initially reported? How did the child act? How consistent was the child in reporting the incident in subsequent conversations with authorities or other individuals in the investigation? Under Senate Bill 275, prior statements of a child under 10 would be admissible in a criminal or juvenile proceeding, provided there are, quote, substantial indicia of reliability surrounding the statement or statements. And the bill provides a list of criteria to determine what is substantial indicia of reliability. The DA's Association urges this committee to find that the bill is needed both from child welfare and from legal considerations. There are an increasing number of cases in which a very young child reports to a friend, teacher, or relative that he or she has been sexually abused. In child abuse cases, their statements are often, those often provide crucial evidence, since physical evidence is usually lacking, and there are seldom other witnesses to the abuse. A child's statement to another outside the courtroom setting also may contain details and spontaneity absent in the child's later testimony about the events. In addition, the child victim may be unavailable to testify at trial. Situations where the child may not be able to testify include cases involving extremely young children who may not be competent to or able to communicate or able to remember what happened to them, or other child victims who would be intimidated by the defendant into not testifying or highly traumatized emotionally by testifying in a courtroom setting. When the child is unavailable, the out-of-court statement may provide the victim's only account of the incident. Even if the perpetrator has confessed to the crime, a conviction cannot be obtained based upon the confession alone. Absent a conviction, the offender is free to continue the abuse of that child or other children. As of checking last week, 33 states have now adopted legislation similar to this. The bill, Senate Bill 275, is based upon Washington law, which in turn is based upon a model presented by the American Bar Association. Any law which admits hearsay statements raises, of course, appropriate concern regarding possible violation of the defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him or her. This bill goes a long way to protect that important right. Decisions of the United States Supreme Court have included or have indicated that the Confrontation Clause poses no obstacle to the admission of out-of-court statements when the person who made the statement testifies at trial. Since the witness is under oath, the defendant has the opportunity to cross-examine the witness about the out-of-court statement, and the jury can assess the demeanor of the witness. In Ohio versus Roberts, a 1980 United States Supreme Court case, the court stated that even if the person who made the statement is not present to testify at trial, the defendant's right of confrontation is not violated, provided there are, quote, adequate indicia of reliability, unquote, to the out-of-court statement. Here, Senate Bill 275 goes even further. One, whether the witness testifies or not, there must be such indicia. Two, the bill provides a list of common sense and case-made criteria defining, quote, indicia of reliability, unquote. Arguably, the bill requires an even greater degree of reliability since the bill requires substantial indicia, not just adequate indicia. Four, the bill requires advance notice to the adverse party by the proponent of the statement, thus allowing the party against whom the statement will be used to prepare to meet the statement. Five, where the child is not available as a witness, the child's statement is not admissible unless there is corroborative evidence of the act of sexual conduct. Such evidence could include a confession, eyewitness account, physical evidence, and access by the accused. Thus, the defendant's rights are protected under the United States Constitution, and the Oregon Supreme Court has indicated an intent to follow the same criteria in interpreting the Oregon Constitution. The constitutionality of the first two state laws adopting this model, Washington and Kansas, have been upheld in the highest courts of both states. This bill, as I indicated, passed the House last time, and we would urge the Senate to push this bill forward this time. Thank you.
Are there questions of John? Senator Grinsky.
I would think that one substantial protection to ensure that the opposition has an opportunity to prepare for this type of hearsay when the witness will be unavailable to testify would be the notice of an intention to offer the statement. And of concern to me is the fact that the statute, or the proposed statute, would only require that the statement, the particulars, be provided sufficiently in advance of the proceeding to provide the adverse party a fair opportunity. I'm wondering if you think that's going to work as a practical matter rather than actually stating a time period.
I think it's going to be something that would be supervised by the judge. So what is an adequate opportunity to respond would be something for the judge to determine on a case-by-case basis. It may be a minor statement that the party has already gotten as a matter of discovery, mm-hmm. and thus additional notice may be sort of a formality, or it may be something else. If it certainly, I would say that if defense counsel is unaware of a statement, the court would give them ample opportunity to prepare.
There is a statute that requires the beginning of prior sexual misconduct as a defense, and there's a time frame for using that, and it's specific. I think it's 7 days or 10 days prior to the hearing or trial.
I think you're talking about the so-called rape shield law. That does require notice be given a certain period of time prior to.
I'm wondering why not do the same with this. What I can see happening is the prosecution or defense waiting till the day before the hearing, giving the notice over. The judge says, well, we're going to go ahead and let this evidence in anyway. It's a discretionary thing, and I don't think it's that big of a deal. And so what the other attorney gets is a right to an appeal, basically, which isn't worth much in a lot of cases. And I'm just wondering if we can put a time frame on the rape shield defense, which also is something that's flexible depending on what type of a case it is, and yet the committee that put that bill together felt that it was appropriate to have a specific time. I think maybe a specific time might be in order, because I just don't see this working well. There's not the kind of communication, as you know, between a judge, the defense lawyer, and the district attorney about these types of details prior to a hearing. Frequently, they don't even get together until the date of the trial, and it gets lost in the paperwork. It'll be a form notice that'll get sent out, and the judge may not have time to rule on it before it's time for the trial, and it just fouls everything up at that point. Maybe the other side will want a continuance, and he'll have to notify all of his witnesses or whatever.
I guess, speaking for my county, I don't see it as a problem as drafted, but there may very well be problems in other counties, and if the committee thinks that a specific period of time in advance is appropriate, certainly the VA Association would not object to that.
If I was the attorney with the notice, I would wonder if I'd complied with this statute. Is a day enough? Is a week enough? Is a month enough? How are you going to make that kind of decision? And you can't when the thing just says to provide the adverse party a fair opportunity to prepare to meet the statement. That is so ambiguous. I don't know how the other side would ever know if they had received enough time or if I had given them enough time.
I guess, Senator Grinsky, I compare it to discovery in general, that there's no specific guidelines. So there may be in the court rules, there are no specific guidelines for that. And the question of adequate notice on discovery comes up all the time.
Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
John, what's been the experience in Washington thus far?
I've heard nothing adverse to the experience in Washington, and I do know that on the constitutional issue, it's been upheld in that state.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Who else is at the table, please?
Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Deborah Wilson, and I'm here from the Attorney General's Office, Department of Justice. I'm the attorney in charge of the Family Enforcement Section. Basically, I supervise the attorneys located around the state who do litigation for Children's Services Division and also for Support Enforcement Division. I've submitted testimony here today. It parallels the testimony of the Governor's Office, the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and Children's Services Division, so I won't repeat it here today. However, if you have any further questions, I'd be willing to answer those at this time. And for the record, we do urge the support and passage of this bill.
Okay, let's, we're sort of conferring here because I have to go to another hearing, but in the meantime, we'll call up Robert Reed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and Senators. My name is Robert Reed, and I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association.
Yeah, those things are just immovable, and they're not just...
I won't touch it again.
Right, thanks.
I've done exclusively criminal defense law in Lane County for the past 8 years. I would like to point out briefly some background about this bill. The gentleman that spoke before me referred to Ohio versus Roberts. That United States Supreme Court case basically said that hearsay by a non-witness cannot be allowed in a trial against a citizen charged with a crime unless it's shown both to be the citizen's unavailable and the statement is reliable. This law is designed to do one thing, and it's designed to get more criminal convictions. It is not designed to ensure fair trials or make sure that evidence is reliable. If you look at the definition of unavailability carefully, you will see something that is unknown in Oregon law heretofore, and that is a person is unavailable if they have any lapse of memory at all. I submit to you that in every single case you're going to find a judge being able to agree that the child does not have a complete memory about an incident that happened. It never happens that someone remembers something fully. So in every case they're going to be able to find that the person is unavailable. Also, if you read carefully, the criteria set forth showing what is reliable and what is not, you will see that they are designed again so that only one conclusion can be found. Look, for example, at letter I in the list of factors, whether the child's young age makes it unlikely that the child fabricated a statement that represents a graphic, detailed account beyond the child's knowledge and experience. Again, that is written, as are several of these other factors, in such a way that there can only be one conclusion. This law is unnecessary and it's dangerous. It is unnecessary because already nationwide and statewide, well over 90% of all people charged with crimes end up pleading guilty. Of those people that go to trial on these kind of cases, in the 10,000 some criminal cases I have seen, well over 95% are convicted of this kind of crime. It is dangerous because it essentially allows a person to be tried for a criminal charge without any confrontation of the person that's made that accusation. It will, when children make these statements, they aren't written down and immediately sent to court. They are processed through CSD workers, district attorney's offices, and police associations. Then they get to court. That's going to be the statement that jurors see in this case. I also can say from personal experience, between 25 and 30% of child abuse cases involve a bitter custody dispute or some kind of breakup issue where one parent is encouraging the child to make allegations. I'm not going to make the statement that children always lie, because obviously they don't. There's a great problem in this state and every state with child sex abuse, but there is also a problem with parents who are willing to use a child as a pawn in a manipulative game to get back at someone. I've seen a lot of these cases myself. This kind of law will only encourage and exacerbate that manipulation and abusive process. I urge you to carefully take a look at this bill before you decide on how you want to vote on it. Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Hill.
Yes. If you acknowledge that this is a problem,
yes,
then what is your alternative for solving this problem, to help us to prosecute this, to deal with the problem?
Well, sir, I read in the Register Guard that between 1975 and 1985, because of education in elementary schools aimed at making young children feel free and aware to make reports on things like this, then the reporting has gone up and the incidence has gone down. I think publicity and education are the answers here.
But what we're, Madam Chair, what we're talking about, though, is getting, once these cases get to court, which they will.
Yes.
And it really is something that's just really come out of the closet.
Yes.
Recently, I'm saying, in terms of a procedure for trying these cases, what do you offer as a better alternative to this? Now, the courts have said that this is constitutional, as I understand it.
Well, sometimes, maybe not the way it's written here, but are you suggesting that there is a problem that children should not be allowed to testify in court, or there's some emotional problems caused by that?
I'm saying that a scheme has been put forth here to help us in prosecuting. We realize that this is a big problem.
Okay, yes.
And we're trying to solve it. And I want to know, what alternative do you see? I mean, do you say that we should not do anything to the
no.
law? I'm trying to...
A law that said that statements made by children may be used against the defendant if the child testifies in court and he's impeached. The defense lawyer says, well, isn't it true you said this or that? A law that says that you could bring those prior statements in at that time would be fine, and we have such a law. A law that says statements made for medical or medical diagnosis or something similar like that to a doctor, something under a situation where they're not directly reporting a crime to someone who might have an interest, like a angered stepmother or something, that would be fine. We already have a law like that. The very best thing that you can get, and I'll tell you as a defense lawyer, the most devastating testimony that you can see in court is for the child to get up on the stand and make the accusation then. That's what the right of confrontation is about. There is no reason that that can't work, and in fact, it does work in almost every case. The children get up on the stand and they make the accusation then. There's nothing wrong with that, and that's what happens now. That's why I said there's no need to change the law, because there's a very, very small percentage of these cases that don't result in convictions. Any other questions? I thank you for your attention.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, just one second.
Mr. Reed, you mentioned on line 14, the language regarding incomplete memory. Did you have a suggestion for an amendment to that of some kind?
Well, I don't see any problem with the current definition of unavailability. If you put complete lack of memory, which I think is the current law, that would be fine, because in most cases, anyone, a child or an adult, isn't going to remember something totally. But complete lack of memory is the status of the law. Now, if a person just can't remember the basic substance of what they complained earlier, then that would comply with current law. What I'm trying to say, the bottom line here, is the ODAA has been trying to push this bill through to make convictions easier for the past several years. The law is fine as it is, and it works without tampering and eviscerating the constitutional rights of citizens. And when I'm talking about people charged with these kind of crimes, I'm not just talking about some slimeball criminal image we have. I'm talking about teachers, clergymen, coaches, all kinds of people in the community that get accused of these charges, sometimes wrongfully.
Yes, I just want to ask you now, we're not the first ones to act on this type of law.
I understand that.
And we're talking about 33 other states have now, and I mean, you're talking as if we're doing this for the first time and that we're trying to make up a need that isn't there. And that's why I'm trying to, you tell us that there's no need for a change. We have 33 states that have made a similar change.
Well, the 33 states have made a similar change since 1980, and they've basically enacted laws that says if a witness doesn't appear in court, you can use the testimony, hearsay statement, if the witness is unavailable and if it's shown that the statement is reliable. That's what those 33 states have done, and that's fine. That comports with constitutional law at state and federal level. I haven't seen the 33 bills, but I will warrant that they will not get past constitutional muster if they're written like this bill is. This bill basically allows conviction of a person on a serious felony without ever getting to see their accuser, on a situation where someone may not remember 3% of their testimony and where it's almost automatically, by the terms of the bill, decided to be reliable.
I would just say that we don't want to pass anything that's unconstitutional. My sense of it, though, is that there's a good possibility this type of legislation will be passed, and then what I would do is like to get your help in putting a bill together that is constitutional.
Okay. I'd be more than willing to work with counsel on that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next witness would be Mark Blackman.
Good afternoon. Mark Blackman, appearing on behalf of the ACLU. I really want to focus my comments on two issues that I think demonstrate the danger that this bill presents. The first, and the one that is, I think, of greatest concern to me personally, as well as, I think, to the ACLU, is the fact that this bill makes admissible a statement of a witness who is deemed incompetent. Competency under our code of evidence, and it's very difficult to discuss these issues without getting lost in legalese, and I'll try to avoid that. But when the code of evidence was adopted very recently, the definition of competence was also amended to be very, very minimal, so that a witness is now competent if that person has organs of sense and can perceive, and once perceiving, can make known the perception to others. That is all it takes to be deemed competent in our state, the ability to perceive and the ability to present that perception to others. I submit to you that a witness who does not have that minimal capacity either to perceive or communicate should not be deemed such that their prior statements are admissible in a court of law. By definition, it should be just the opposite. If the person lacks the capacity to perceive in the first place or to accurately report, then our rules of procedure, protection of the process of finding the truth, would indicate to me anyway, and it seems so logical, it's hard for me to say it any other way, that that's exactly the person who should be subjected to the tests of truthfulness that come with a judicial proceeding, not the opposite. And I submit to you that the real danger in this bill is it takes the least reliable witnesses, those who don't qualify as competent under this very minimal standard, and insulates them entirely from any process to determine whether there's any truthfulness or lack of truthfulness to their statement. It is I would urge you to recognize a very dangerous thing indeed to present this type of evidence, especially in the highly emotionally charged kinds of cases that are normally going to be involved here. Competence is a minimal requirement, and this statute only exacerbates an existing problem. The other point I would make is that unlike any other state, Oregon has a constitutional provision which specifically precludes the admissibility of hearsay statements except, and I'll quote from the Oregon Supreme Court case that established the principle, except as to those well established, as a quote from State Ex Rel Lonergan v. Gladden, except for those statements which are well-established exceptions to the hearsay rule. And basically what the court has said in the past is that a hearsay exception that was in existence at the time of the adoption of the Oregon Constitution is immune from attack under our Confrontation Clause, but that unless it was well-established at that time, it violates Article 1, Section 11 of the Oregon Constitution. No other state has that provision in its constitution. Oregon is one of very few states that specifically has interpreted its constitutional provision regarding the right to meet witnesses face-to-face, and that's the language our Constitution uses, different from the federal Constitution, to be more rigorous in its protection of the process. And so for those two principles,
and especially when the matter of controversy is important as child sexual abuse. In child sexual abuse cases, the judge and the jury are entitled to obtain the elusive and incommunicable evidence of a witness, deportment, or witness's deportment while testifying, and the certain subjective moral effect produced upon the witness in child sexual abuse cases. Just as in all other criminal cases, often actions speak louder than words. To deprive a person accused of child sexual abuse of the right to obtain the demeanor evidence that in person, in court testimony can only provide is to remove from the truth-finding process an important tool. Shall we turn our back upon the ancient wisdom of mankind concerning the one of the best methods of arriving at truth, so tried and true that they are found in the Holy Bible? Shall we turn our back on the wisdom of the pioneers who established our state's constitutional ground rules for accurate ascertainment of truth? Or shall we do to perceive popular opinion? And I mean, I stress popular opinion, the witch hunt or whatever you want to call it. Reject these principles that make the accurate ascertainment of truth more possible? Stated another way, shall we sacrifice the conviction of an innocent or a number of innocents because of admitted discomfort occasioned by testifying? I am certain that we are close in our feelings that child abuse in any form is the worst of crimes. The next in line is to be falsely accused of child abuse, let alone being falsely accused and found guilty of abuse of a child or children. The allowing of the use of hearsay evidence provided by a child that has been interrogated, prompted, coerced by an agency personnel or investigators is not in the best interest of the justice system. One of the primary supporters of House Bill 2367, he's also here today, I might tell you, it's D.A., Penn, has stated that simply because a jury has acquitted the defendant does not mean the defendant is innocent. Now, I have him on videotape saying that. Well, you know, it's always been the presumption of innocence until proven guilty, but you see, if you're on the prosecution side of this, you feel the other way about it, obviously. I maintain that the opposite also occurs on occasions. Individuals that are found guilty are innocent. We all know that it's the responsibility of the prosecutor to provide evidence to the jury that the defendant is guilty without the violation of the defendant's constitutional rights or without a shadow of a doubt of a violation of those rights.
Thank you. There are questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cinda Noel.
I'm Cindy Nolan. I'm the mother of a 3.5-year-old daughter that has told several authorities, myself, that she's been sexually abused by her own father. We have doctor's evidence. She told the doctor also, plus there's physical evidence that she has been sexually abused. She told the doctor and several authorities that she has been. And yet, a 3.5-year-old child, she can talk plain enough to tell people, but when she got up, she talked between seven, she went before a seven-person jury, and there was an indictment. They felt that, you know, she was a competent witness, but then she still had to go before the judge and be cross-examined by two attorneys, the DA and the opposing attorney, her father's attorney, with the father sitting right there within a few feet of her looking at her, and he was whispering things to her. And she made it through this, which was very hard. It went through 2 hours. I didn't even know she was going to make it through. There was crying, and they'd break, and then she'd break down and cry and say, this is so hard to talk about. You know, this is so hard to talk about. He committed sodomy on this child. I mean, she shows us the act. She takes the dolls. She shows you everything. I had no idea any of this was going on until I saw her show this before the police officer and the child services department. I love my husband very much, and I hate what he did, and I would never take a chance to let him do it again. But they say, with the doctor's evidence, with all the people she's told and everything, all this stuff, if she goes before this jury, you know, and she can't talk, which she had a hard time doing, if she sits there in front of all these people and can't talk, that's it. There's no case. No matter how many people she told, no matter what the physical evidence is, we have no case whatsoever. She can't speak up and talk to that jury. And she just barely made it through the competency hearing. And I can't understand why they can't use the doctor's report. She told the doctor the same things. She told a police officer, children's services, more than one police officer. None of their testimonies are any good. None of them can say anything. Nothing is any good. If she can't herself sit before her father again, who she loves very much, she hates what he done, she'll tell you over and over, I don't want Daddy to do these bad things to me anymore. You know, but I love Daddy and I miss Daddy. And every day she'll sit there and she'll cry and she'll say, Mommy, I don't want Daddy to do these things anymore, but I miss him and I love Daddy. When I can just imagine the horror that it's going to, it was already been horrible enough, all the trials, all the cross-examinations we've been through. Now here she is, just barely 3.5 go before and testify in front of all these people. And she is frightened. She's very frightened. And it's hard enough on children that are older, knowing what other people are going to think and what their friends are going to think and family, let alone a 3.5-year-old that loves her daddy very much but doesn't want to be abused anymore. I feel like I'm here for both the being able to, the 275, the hearsay, and the videotape, because I feel that she should be able to be videotaped and not have to sit before all those people in a big courtroom as she did during the competency hearing. Of course, there wasn't 12 other people. I don't understand why authorities that have heard her testimony, people that, you know, an officer, children's services, why they can't testify also of what she said if she's not able to come forth and say it.
Thank you very much for coming. Other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
There seem to be sort of two issues within this bill. One issue is whether the child should be required to appear before the jury in the trial. The other issue is whether or not the report of the investigation should be introduced in evidence. Now you could still introduce the report if you still required the child to be a witness.
Okay, well, I was told by the district attorney that if she didn't herself tell the jury what happened to her in her own words, that then nobody else would be able to go, you
right.
know, there would
and,
be no
and,
case.
And that's sort of the way it is now. And this bill would say, no, in certain circumstances, you can bring in this investigation report and that will be evidence. You can use that if the child testifies also, or if the child is unavailable, you can use it without the child being there. In Now, what I'd like to ask you is, assuming that we say, yes, you can bring in the report, you can use it, but only if the child is available in the courtroom to be questioned by whoever. And I'm asking this of you because you're the one who would have to live with this. Would that be an acceptable solution to you? In other words, I know it would be a great ordeal. Is it to spare her the ordeal that you feel it's important that we pass
She's
this
already
law?
Gone through such a terrible ordeal that it's already affecting her a lot. You know, she's already been through more than I even care to, you know, it's so hard to talk about. She's been through much cross-examinations, even, you know, before the competency hearing and since it. But what I'm saying is, what if she gets up there and she just falls apart and starts crying, which she did towards the end of the competency hearing, and then they just say, well, she can't testify, look at her, she can't talk. You know, I feel that they should be able to bring in the testimony,
okay,
the ones that she
talked. Okay, yes, they can. They can bring in the other testimony, and that will be good evidence. Do you feel that even with that your child should be spared having to be there? Or do you think it's fair enough?
I definitely feel she should be spared, yes.
Do you think it's fair that the defendant be convicted without her being there?
Well, he's already been there in front of her and you know, at the competency hearing, and you know, before she was even qualified to go here, he was able to sit right there and listen to everything she said. I don't understand the reason why.
Because the jury is going to find him guilty or not guilty of child abuse.
Right, but what does that have to do if her father is sitting right there? I mean, can you imagine a child of any age having to sit there and testify against somebody they really, really love?
No, it's tough.
It would be hard enough for me.
Very tough, but the other side is that the person is going to be convicted and sent to prison. And that's pretty serious, too.
It's pretty serious. They get back out and are allowed to do it over and over again, which is happening all the time.
I know that.
Because the child can't testify against
the
father.
What I'm trying to learn from you is whether or not you think, everything considered, it's important that, would it be endurable for your child to testify again on this matter before the court?
This is what I don't know. How would I, you know, she barely made it through the competency hearing, and there wasn't even, that was only like 2 hours. Now they're talking about 3 days or more. I just don't know.
She wouldn't have to be there the whole 3 days. She'd be on the stand once. She'd be there just during the time she's testifying, which wouldn't take the whole 3 days, of course.
I guess we've got a lot of other witnesses.
Well, I know. This is a real sensitive one.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leonard Williamson.
Honorable Chairperson Cohen,
yes,
my name
please.
Is Leonard Williamson, and I am a second-year law student at the University of Oregon, and I've been encouraged by Professor Laird Kirkpatrick to come before you and address Senate Bill 275 and Senate Bill 516. I don't want to waste any more of your time. Much of what I've heard from the governor's office and from Corey, I agree with. And I do have some concerns about Senate Bill 275 in that the test for determining whether a child is unavailable leaves to the discretion of the judge much too much leeway, I think. Possibly if the committee could define a better test as to what incompetent means. There's already a test for unavailability. In addition to that, Senate Bill.
Can I stop you right now?
Sure.
We've already heard testimony that a competency hearing in one case lasted 2 hours and was fairly difficult for a 3.5-year-old.
That's correct.
Is that, what's your response to that? Is that too much? Is that enough? What, are we in a, what would be your written suggestions of any way the legislature could define a competency hearing and what is incompetent?
without listening to all of that.
I think that possibly a better exception is the Uniform Rule 807. And I don't know how many of you have seen it before. I understand part of Senate Bill 516 was taken from that. And it's one of the last pieces in my presentation. It doesn't go about testing the competency of the child, but what it does, if the child is going to suffer severe emotional or psychological harm, then the judge can determine whether or not such evidence as a videotaped session with a psychologist can be let in. And the judge must examine that first in camera. And if he determines that it is reliable, then it can go before the jury to be seen. The psychologist must be available for cross-examination, which would secure for the defendant a more possibility of testing the reliability. Additionally, I'd like to say that Senate Bill 275 does not address whether or not these type of statements could be in a civil case where there hasn't been criminal charges brought, for example, against a father, but the issue is whether or not he's competent as a caregiver, and this bill doesn't address whether or not those kind of statements could come in. There would have to be criminal prosecution first, or juvenile proceedings. I've included a smaller version of Coy versus Iowa that went before the Supreme Court that kind of summarizes it. That may give you some help as to
that's
the
really
confrontation
to,
problem.
To 516, right?
Right.
Okay. Further comments?
None.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your work on this, and we'll follow up with some of your suggestions. Bobby Helberg, is that how it is?
Madam Chairman, committee, I'm the chairperson of the Oregon chapter of Save Our Family Ties. If someone would have told me a little over a year ago that I would be actively entrenched in legal battles with the state of Oregon, Children's Services Division, the district attorneys in Douglas County and Josephine County, I would have thought you foolish and I would have laughed at you. But I am currently involved, entrenched in these battles, and I am fighting. We at SOFT are now seeking some of our Oregon laws to be changed for the betterment of all children and families concerned. Abuse, we're not saying that abuse doesn't happen. In fact, we are staunchly against any type of abuse, and we think that a person who is truly guilty of abuse should be charged with a felony, and the truly guilty party should be sent to prison and the key thrown away. But only after a complete, competent, thorough, unbiased, and non-prejudicial investigation. And that should be done before anyone is charged with any child abuse crime. But unfortunately, most of the charges that are currently being pursued and prosecuted have not been investigated properly. We also think that anyone turning in a false accusation, and that should include any caseworker who, without any reliable or credible evidence, be charged with a felony false reporting of child abuse and should be sent to prison for the maximum time that the law would allow. Let me tell you about somebody who was falsely accused, charged, and convicted of rape, sexual abuse. Joe was a trusted employee. He had previously been persecuted by his family, not for child abuse or sexual abuse, and he moved to another area. He located a job that he held with high esteem and respect. Joe had been given responsibilities and duties that were because he proved to be a trusted and honest employee. His employer allowed him access to his home and everything within it, and again, with no questions or restrictions. The employer's wife, however, thought Joe to be handsome. She lustfully made advances toward him. Joe at first thought she was only paying him a compliment and refused all advances, but never gave her any reason to believe he was interested in her more than respecting her, his employer's wife. He consistently ignored all the advances. No, I'm a trusted employee and I respect my employer. One day she called after him and asked him to come over. She immediately set her plan into action. She got herself ready for him. When Joe arrived, she made her usual advances and asked Joe to lie with her, and still he refused. She then tore off the jacket, and with that, he immediately fled and ran. To make her accusations look good, she screamed and was heard by others. She immediately told those who came to her rescue that she was raped by Joe and that he was a trusted employee of her husband. Before her husband came home, she forced herself to be visibly upset, and still with Joe's jacket, she went into the bedroom and proceeded to lay down with Joe's jacket next to her, waiting for him to get home. She then reported to her husband that his trusted employee, Joe, had raped her. With that information, her husband had Joe arrested, convicted, and sent to prison because these types of cases, you normally cannot receive a fair and impartial trial. Joe is Joseph, Jacob's son by Rachel, Jacob's favorite, in the Holy Bible, Genesis 39, 1 through 23. He was falsely accused of rape approximately 1893 BC, and to this day, people are still being falsely accused of child abuse, sexual abuse, and even rape. We haven't learned a thing since 1893. If Senate Bill 275 plus the other hearsay evidence bills are passed, and if this incident happened today, and God help Joe, especially if the victim was under 10 years of age, CSD, law enforcement agencies, mental health, or someone who has an axe to grind would be allowed to retell the alleged events if that child was unavailable as a witness. Even if the child testifies at the proceeding and does not remember all the details, then someone else can and will fill in the details that were left out and do the talking for the child and may tell just what the child told them or what they thought they heard or wanted to hear. With allowing someone else to tell of the incidents, that person may be an accomplished, well-trained expert in testifying in court and could convince a jury that the alleged abuse actually happened. This bill is very dangerous. It is serious. Not only does it jeopardize the scales of justice, it jeopardizes the many innocent families who could be destroyed by the lack of proper investigation in cases of child sexual abuse. To allow hearsay evidence, especially for this type of alleged crime, not only goes against our Oregon Constitution, it goes against the highest authority in America, the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I realize that this incident was not about child abuse, but it is indicative of many of the false accusations and charges that happen daily here in Oregon, and especially when someone is accused of child sexual abuse. We at Save Our Family Ties hope that Oregon will be one of the first to enact investigation laws regarding any child abuse report or case and will place stiff penalties on reporting false reports and accusations, even if the caseworker receives and acts on false accusations, that they also be charged, dismissed, or sanctioned. We, at Save Our Family Ties, are opposed to Senate Bill 275 and hope you will carefully look into the hidden and vague meanings of the Governor Goldsmith's children's agenda. It is a dangerous and serious agenda.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Carolyn Davidson? Carolyn's coming up, Senator Hill has a question.
Thank you. And if it gets to be too involved, I don't want to take up too much time. You obviously, there have been other experiences that are directly on point with what this bill is about concerning child abuse. Do you have any specific experiences?
Yes. My husband has been charged in Douglas County with three counts of misdemeanor sexual abuse and one count in Josephine County, which he was acquitted on. He was found not guilty. And as Dale Penn says, a not guilty does not mean that the person is innocent. But she was 16 years old when she ran away with her boyfriend and did not want to come home and claim sexual abuse. She was, and I will talk on issue 516 because of, I do have a prepared statement for that also. But I'm totally against this. And I know that I know that children, it is emotional for children to have to stand in front of a jury and the true child abuser. It is emotional. But it's also very emotional for a falsely accused person to sit there and listen to their daughter talk about things that never happened. There's two sides to that coin.
Madam Chair? I agree with you in that I think probably next to being a child abuser, being accused of being a child abuser is right there. But I'm also aware of the fact that district attorney's offices generally are very careful before they begin prosecution of these. Now, my question is this. Did your husband have an opportunity to take a polygraph exam?
No.
Did he could have gotten a private one and then shown it to the district attorney. Did he do that?
Nobody asked. Nobody. There were no questions asked by CSD, law enforcement agencies, district attorneys, state police, the state of Washington, the state of Oregon. No one. In fact, in
Wait a minute.
No one has asked.
You know what a polygraph exam is?
Yes, I am aware.
Did you ever ask your attorney?
We asked our attorney, and he did not suggest that we take it.
You had a bad lawyer. Don't blame that on the system, though.
No, I'm not blaming it on the system. But, however, in Josephine County, that same lawyer who told us not to take the polygraph, after he tried to get my husband to cut a plea on a charge that was dropped in Douglas County because of no evidence, and no, they could not prosecute. Immediately, 2 days later, charges came down in Josephine County. And he has gone to trial the eighth and ninth of this month, and he was found not guilty in 35 minutes by a jury.
Okay, the only thing I can tell you on that, I have never seen a district attorney yet that would prosecute a case where the defendant passed a polygraph exam.
Okay, and we can talk that on.
If you feel your husband's being charged with something that he has nothing to do with, then you should have no trouble passing a polygraph exam.
But a polygraph test is not admissible
in
court.
We're going to cut this up because there's lots of folks here wanting to talk about the specifics of the bills rather than the specific of your cases as unfair.
Right, I can't discuss it anyway because it's...
I know.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carolyn Davidson?
I'd like to speak on both...
If you just give us your name.
Carolyn Davidson.
Right. Thank you.
I'd like to speak on both of the bills, if possible, 275 and 384. Is it possible to address both of them? Or?
We don't have 384.
Is the videotaping one?
Yes, 516.
Okay. Is it all right to address both
do.
Of them? It's difficult for me to be here today and listen to the other people's stories. I can't quote law, and I can't quote what's constitutional and what isn't. I can just convey, as other mothers have and other people have, their feelings. It's only because of an unfortunate twist of fate that I have to be here before you today. You see, my son has alleged that his natural father sexually assaulted him during a regularly scheduled summer visitation with him. Zachary first told me of this alleged abuse 2 years ago, and it would be in the September of 1989 when he returned from visitation, and it was out of state. So you've heard from in-state type things happening. This happened between two states, and if people think they have trouble with the court systems in one state, you ought to try dealing with two. He was only 5 years old then, and he'll be eight in 2 weeks. And I'd like to address some of the things some of the other people have said so far. First of all, I was very insulted about the statistics and would like to see where they were gotten from, that most of these are custody cases and mothers or fathers had coerced their children into saying that. And I'd also like to see somebody with a five-year-old who could actually get them to repeat a story like that, where I have a hard time with Zachary nearing 8 years old to remember to say thank you. I don't see how he could have gone through time and time again with these hearings, depositions, and come up with the same story time and time again. And if someone had put him up to that, I think is entirely ridiculous. As far as being children being interrogated over and over again by agencies, police, CSD, psychologists, whatever, for them to come up with this story, then that the agency, the policeman, CSD, whatever, could then relate to the courts. The interrogation Zachary suffered was not with the police department. It was not with CSD. It was from the defense attorney. Zachary was allowed to fly back to Iowa and give a deposition. It didn't go to grand jury. Instead, it went to deposition first, since we were dealing with two states. In that deposition, which was videotaped, lasted 3.5 hours, at which time the district attorney just asked Zachary if he knew the difference between a truth and a lie, and then pretty much from there turned it over to the defense attorney, and Zachary was in that room with a bathroom break in between, but for about 3.5 hours, asking questions that I'm sure a judge would not have allowed to be asked. But that's really not what the issue is here. That happened the year after the abuse. The following, about a year and a half later, Zachary finally went to court. The deposition was not allowed to be in court then, although it was videotaped, and the defense attorney pretty much had asked all the questions. My issue seems to be that the videotape was current, the information was accurate. If you're aware with small children what their verbal skills, what they recall, and that in a difference in a 3-year period between age 5 to age 8 is entirely different. And I'm a supporter of the legal system, but let's get the child's most accurate story right, whether he told it to a CSD worker or a policeman or a different agency, maybe a psychologist, whatever, or if it's on a videotape, use that. Don't put them in front of a judge and a jury 3 years later and ask them to say in terms what happened then, because it sounds contradictory. Get the information firsthand and use it from there.
You are in support of using some form of videotaping then.
Some form of videotape and some form of hearsay. The other thing I would like to tell you is, in our trial, since the CSD worker was not there in person and the psychologist who Zachary has dealt with now for 3 years was not there in person, none of that was able to be admitted as evidence.